Welcome back to the third hour of Issues Etc. We've got two guests ahead for you. In the last hour, we'll be talking with Art Vanek about the Book of Mormon, and then Pastor Bill Swirla, he has reflected briefly on a simple one-word question, why, on his blog, Why Katrina. We'll be answering that question and talking about Hurricane Katrina and the theology of the cross in the last 25 minutes of Issues, etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Art Vanek joins us. He's a member of the Spalding Research Group, and he's co-author of Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for September, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon, The Spalding Enigma. Art, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Well, thank you for having me on your show today.
So let's answer the question right up front.
Okay.
As far as you can tell from all of the primary source historical material, who really wrote the Book of Mormon?
Well, according to all of our research, a retired Congregationalist minister by the name of Solomon Spalding is the true author of what we now know as the Book of Mormon.
Now, did he write the Book of Mormon, Chapter 1?
No. What he wrote was a manuscript that he submitted to the Patterson Publishing print shop in Pittsburgh in 1814, and its original title was called Manuscript Found, and it was the second of two manuscripts that he wrote. And the Patterson Print Shop agreed to publish his manuscript on the proviso that he come up with some, like, seed money or whatever to start the printing process. Unfortunately, Spalding died in 1816, without ever having raised the necessary money. So the manuscript lay at the Patterson Print Shop and basically was never published.
Now, he was publishing this as fiction.
Correct. He meant it to be nothing more than the romantic history of the American Indians, and he was one of a rather large group of scholars at the time who were all under the basic impression that the American Indians were descended from the lost tribes of Israel. And that notion pretty much got its start, I think, around the time of the Revolutionary War and pretty much petered out by around the 1850s or so.
So there was some kind of a scholarly consensus there near the turn of the 19th century in America that Native Americans were, in fact, of Jewish lineage.
Correct. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because, you know, we claim that Joseph Smith basically plagiarized, well, in fact, plagiarized from Solomon Spalding, but then Spalding, for his part, plagiarized from a number of sources himself, including a man named James Adair in his History of the American Indians, or at least borrowed, shall we say, quite liberally. And you can find some parallels between Adair's book and Spalding's writings, and there are some other historians as well.
You know, this sets up kind of a strange, and I know historians hate the what-ifs,
yeah,
the hypothetical, but it strikes me that if Solomon Spalding had lived to publish Manuscript Found, there would be no Book of Mormon and likely no Mormonism.
Well, yeah, that's the way we feel about it, too.
So let's trace this manuscript left at the death of its author, gathering dust in a print shop in Pennsylvania, to Joseph Smith's claims regarding golden plates and seer stones and divine revelation.
Okay.
How did it get from point A to point B?
Well, now to actually completely cover that, you have to go back to as early as 1814 when Spalding submitted the manuscript to Patterson.
Okay.
Around that time, it came up missing for a while, and both Spalding and his wife, before Spalding passed away, both suspected a man named Sidney Rigdon of acquiring the manuscript. Now, Sidney Rigdon is an interesting character all by himself and part of the trio responsible for bringing forth what is now known as the Book of Mormon. Sidney Rigdon was known as a fiery circuit riding preacher. He started out first as a Baptist, then he became later on a Campbellite, And after getting pretty much removed from both of those, still had this burning desire to become like a New World version of Paul. And according to the testimony of several witnesses, around the time that Spalding was alive, Rigdon had a tannery and bookbinding operation, and he was known to frequent most of the publishers and print shops of Pittsburgh. And several of these same witnesses also placed Rigdon at the Patterson print shop. So it is our belief that at some time, either in 1814 when the Spaldings first suspected him of doing it, or later on, even after Spalding's death, Rigdon acquired the manuscript and got in touch with Oliver Cowdery, who was a relative of Smith's and who later became Smith's chief scribe during the entire translation process between 1827 and 1829. So together, Sidney Rigdon, Oliver Cowdery, and Joseph Smith took Spalding's manuscript, edited it, put in sections of the King James Bible, local folk tales, you name it. And over that period of years, slowly turned Spalding's manuscript found into what is now known as the Book of Mormon. Now, in order to make it seem more plausible to neighbors of Smith and family members and the local townspeople, Joseph Smith went through this elaborate kind of P.T. Barnum showmanship sort of thing, where he basically stood behind a curtain and allegedly translated the Reformed Egyptian, which he claimed the golden plates were written in, into regular English. And he did this by looking into a hat that had what he called seer stones inside. And somehow through the power of God and the Holy Spirit, he was enabled to translate the Reformed Egyptian page by page, sentence by sentence, into the Book of Mormon. How are we doing so far?
Well, the line seems pretty straight so far. Do we have the manuscript? Do we have any copies, anything, of Spalding's original manuscript found?
No, we do not. No, we do not. The closest that we feel we ever came to establishing that was back in the late 1970s when we came out with our first book, where we had three handwriting experts examine some pages of the original handwritten manuscript of the Book of Mormon. And these pages were known as the Unidentified Scribe. And of the three handwriting experts who initially all said that it was Spalding's handwriting, two of them kind of got turned away for one reason or another, but the third one went to his death saying that, yes, it in fact was Spalding's handwriting. In our current book, we felt that going back to that issue was completely unnecessary because of the much newer and far more concrete evidence which tied Rigdon to Spalding, which tied Rigdon to Smith, which tied Rigdon to Oliver Cowdery, and how all the key players were placed at the right places and the right times. And if you'll excuse me for getting a little bit on the technical side, an analysis of the two different manuscripts that Spalding wrote. One of them was completely written on something called fool's cap paper, and the other one was written on commercial-grade regular paper. The way these papers, it may sound like a very esoteric issue, but the kinds of paper were completely different. And we have eyewitness testimony that says that Spalding wrote one manuscript on one kind of paper, the other one on another kind of paper. We have, and now one of the key defenses that the Mormons have used against any of this ever being able to take place is they claim that Rigdon was never in Pittsburgh before 1820. So therefore, if he was never there before 1820, he could have never known about the manuscript or Spalding or anything. Case closed. Up until our book, there has never been any concrete evidence to the contrary. But now in our book, we have evidence which shows that Rigdon not only was in Pittsburgh before 1820, but he was also there before Spalding died. And that evidence is through newspaper articles. You know, if you're a member of AOL, you get that little ding and it says, you have mail. Well, there was kind of an early 19th century version of that in the form of the local newspapers. If you were delinquent in picking up mail at the post office where you normally received it, after so many days, the local newspaper would print up a list of all people who had mail waiting for them in the post office. Rigdon's name appears several times in that newspaper. And one time in particular, we have not only Rigdon's name, but in the very same list, Solomon Spaulding's name and Solomon Spaulding's brother's name, John Spaulding. So all of this, while seemingly circumstantial, backs up the claims of several witnesses who say that they saw Sidney Rigdon at the Patterson print shop and at the post office. In fact, the postmistress at the time, Mrs. Eichbaum, identified him by name, said, yes, Rigdon was seen here and at the Patterson print shop.
So what we're looking at here is, and this is of course, from a great distance in history, and we're
correct.
We're talking about some time, but we're dealing here with primary historical sources like the newspapers, like the handwritten letters, like the eyewitness accounts.
Correct.
We're dealing with a situation in which Solomon Spaulding writes a manuscript entitled Manuscript Found. He intends it for publication as fiction. He's building upon kind of the consensus that the American Indians were of Jewish lineage.
Mm-hmm.
He's playing with a lot of the ideas that were common in the day.
Correct.
So before he's able to actually publish it, but the manuscript is in the hands of the publisher, he dies. Even before he dies, that manuscript disappears for some
time. For a while,
time.
Correct.
And you have evidence that Sidney Rigdon, who is connected with Oliver Cowdery and Joseph Smith, is most likely where that manuscript was. It was in his possession.
Correct.
In the meantime.
Correct.
If it isn't, as you say, it is a remarkable coincidence. An unbelievable coincidence.
Yeah, I would say that. I would say that. And you know, many of the witnesses who testified to this testified under oath. And it's very interesting to note that none of the witnesses who testified to seeing Rigdon with the manuscript, to seeing Rigdon at the Patterson print shop, seeing Rigdon with Smith, to seeing, you know, identifying all of the other things, none of them ever recanted their testimonies. None of them ever said they were misquoted. They all went to their deaths, never changing their testimonies. On the other hand, you have the three witnesses and the eight witnesses who have their testimonies in the front of the Book of Mormon, where they say that they saw the plates. Well, all of them, when they were interviewed later on, said that they only saw the plates that Joseph Smith claimed he had by the eye of faith. They never saw these plates physically. They only saw them with the eye of faith. Now,
so they qualified their testimony.
Correct. Not in the Book of Mormon, but years later. So it places a whole different complexion on the whole thing. Also, you have some of the witnesses stating or describing the opening of Spaulding's manuscript. where it says that, you know, the manuscript was discovered in a box that was hidden in an Indian burial mound, and he had to use a lever to open it. And you look at Joseph Smith's story, where it is practically a carbon copy of the way Spalding's manuscript starts. You have other witnesses saying that they saw the same names, many of the same names, like Nephi and Lehi and the Lamanites, in both Solomon Spalding's manuscript and the Book of Mormon. And then one of the biggest identifiers between the two goes right back to a nickname that Solomon Spalding had, which was Old Come to Pass. See, Spalding was kind of the local entertainment during the time that he was writing his manuscript. And his manuscript had so many instances of the phrase, it came to pass, or variants on it, that all of his friends and family and anybody else who heard him read for any period of time came to call him Old Come to Pass. In the 1830 edition of the Book of Mormon, there were over 1,500 occurrences of the phrase, it came to pass, or variants of it. And to give you a comparison between that and the King James Bible, it's something like 15 times as many. So, you know, while there may not be one single piece of evidence that pulls these two things together, there is this burden of pieces of evidence. When you put them all together, it says to us quite plainly that Solomon Spalding wrote the Book of Mormon.
Art, how widely known, or was it even suspected, that there was a connection between Spalding's story and Joseph Smith's later claims to have found the Book of Mormon?
Well, as I said, Spalding and his wife suspected Rigdon back in the 1814s. One of the first times that anything from the Book of Mormon was preached, it was preached in Conneaut, Ohio, which is one of the places where Spalding lived for a while. A gentleman got up in the back of the church and said, "Old Come to Pass is among us again." And then you have Hurlbut, who in the mid-1830s, at the request of people of the city of Conneaut and other places, started investigating into this whole thing. And, of course, as soon as the Spalding family saw the Book of Mormon come out, there was this outcry from them, "My gosh, this is Solomon Spalding's work." So there was kind of a sporadic occurrence of people saying, you know, "Gosh, this was written by Spalding," but it was written in the early 19th century, and communications were bad, travel was very difficult. Had something like this occurred in modern times, I think it could have still been prevented. But back in those days, by the time people, you know, tried to get any sort of information together, it would have been, and it was, way too late.
What was the Book of Mormon at the time of its publication, not only called into question as a matter of fact, but called into question as possibly the result of plagiarism?
Well, there were several newspaper articles where they all basically called the Book of Mormon a fraud. And I think perhaps it was as a result of several of those newspaper articles that people like Hurlbut were brought into the fray and then started investigating it. And, you know, what we call the Spalding authorship claims are as old as the Book of Mormon itself, even though as far as what the Mormons, I guess, would call anti-Mormon origins or explanations for the Book of Mormon, it's probably the least known, because most people work on one or another variation of their claim that Smith wrote the Book of Mormon and that Spalding had nothing to do with it.
Then finally, Art, what kind of reaction have you received from Mormons as individuals or Mormon officialdom to the claims that are put forth in your work?
Well, to the current book, nothing yet. Our first book back in the late 70s got quite a large negative reaction from the church. In the nearly daily and weekly internet searches that we do, they still proclaim that, you know, the Spalding issue is a dead issue, yet there is more effort devoted to proclaiming Spalding to be a dead issue than anything else out there. So, you know, why protest so much if it is, in fact, a dead issue?
Is there any doubt in your mind, with only a minute left, is there any doubt in your mind who really wrote the Book of Mormon?
Not at all. Not at all. And hopefully someday, you know, more and more pieces to the puzzle will come forward and we will be able to say with a certainty Spalding wrote the Book of Mormon.
Art Vanek is a member of the Spalding Research Group, and he's co-author of Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for September, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon? Art, thanks for being our guest.
Oh, thank you for inviting me today. It was a pleasure.
You know, I've been impressed with this work from the first time I looked at it. Even prior to publication, this was some years ago when we talked with Art before, primary historical documents and are the kind of things you're going to find in Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon, laying out a case in very, very careful detail. It's Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for September at $16.99 plus shipping and handling. You go to our website if you'd like to browse before you buy, issuesetc.org, and there you will find an image of Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon and a way to order it. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours and ask for Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon, the Spalding Enigma, the Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for September, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. By the way, Art will be back with us live this Sunday night at 10 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. We're going to continue this conversation, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon, live Sunday night on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Coming up after this break, the big question, of course, as we watch the damage continue, as we watch, even though the storm is long gone, even the body counts to rise, as we watch chaos ensue, as we watch a disaster that will take years to undo continue. The big question, of course, is why? Bill Swirla joins us on the other side of the break, pastor of Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Hacienda Heights, California, to talk about Hurricane Katrina and the theology of the cross. People struggle with this all the time. I have been hearing, all you got to do is turn on the TV and the radio. People are saying, why does it happen? And this pat answers. The pat answers are just that, pat answers. Well, the sun will come out tomorrow. The sun has come out. Still a terrible situation. Where was God? Why did he let this happen? Why didn't he do something? Those are the kind of questions that we ask. We'll give answers on the other side of the break. Pastor Bill Swirla will be our guest. Tomorrow on the program, Christian Nice Guy Syndrome with Paul Coughlin, author of the book No More Christian Nice Guy. We'll be right back with the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Does the Book of Mormon tell the real story of the lost tribes of Israel emigrated to North America, or was the Book of Mormon copied by Joseph Smith from someone else's fiction? Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for September, is called Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon, the Spalding Enigma. The book is $16.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find the Book of the Month there at our homepage, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon, or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for September, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon, the Spalding Enigma, or visit our homepage, issuesetc.org. issuesetc.org.
Grand Canyon. What mean these stones?
Answers with Ken Ham, a popular international speaker and writer on Genesis. Some of us, Ken, are familiar with that verse from Joshua chapter 4 that says, "What mean these stones?" But how does all that relate to the Grand Canyon?
In Joshua 4, we read the account of what happened when Joshua led the Israelites across the Jordan River, and it was on dry ground. God told the people, "Take 12 stones, build a memorial for generations to come, so when children ask, 'What mean these stones?' the parents would not forget to tell them of God's miracle." Sadly, Mark, we read later on that the Israelite fathers did neglect to tell their children about what God had done for them, and their children rebelled against God. I would say a similar situation has occurred today. When most Christian parents take their children to the Grand Canyon, for instance, and their children ask something like, "What mean these stones?" they're usually told, "Oh, the layers of rock at the Grand Canyon formed over millions of years." Fathers seem to have forgotten that the canyon is actually a memorial to the great judgment of the flood of Noah's day. Billions of tons of sediment were deposited in layers. Then at the end of the flood, the canyon was carved quickly by enormous amounts of water. Let's not forget to tell our children the truth about the canyon when they ask, "What mean these stones?"
There's much scientific evidence to confirm there really was a global flood. Find out how when you read Ken Ham's new booklet on Noah's flood when you go to our website, answersradio.com.
Larry Rast, Arthur Just, Carl Fakencher, Kurt Marquardt, Peter Scare, Cameron McKenzie.
You probably recognize these names as regular guests on Issues Etc. But what else do they have in common? Well, they're all members of the Christ-centered, cross-focused faculty of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Dean Wenthe, Walter A. Meyer II, David Scare, Dan Gard, Charles Geeshan, Bill Weinrich.
Have you ever considered the pastoral ministry? Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call them 1-800-481-2155. Preparing Christ-centered, cross-focused pastors for the 21st century. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
John Pless, Hal Senkbeil, Richard Muller, Roland Ziegler.
Do you want more of God's grace? Village Lutheran Church in Ladue is a Bible-believing church faithful to the Scriptures, a place for the whole family, a community that cares with a vibrant, historic Christian liturgy. Village Lutheran Church is located at 9237 Clayton Road in Ladue, www.villagelutheranchurch.org. Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, 314-993-1834.
Welcome back for the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Bill Swirla joins us here for these few minutes. He's pastor of Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Hacienda Heights, California. We're going to talk about Hurricane Katrina and the theology of the cross. Everybody has an answer, don't they? Everybody's got an answer for why this happened. If you ask the meteorologist, he'll tell you why it happened. He can tell you in intimate detail where it came from, why it went where it went, and, of course, now, in retrospect, he can tell you all of the forces that were at work there. But, of course, everyone has a sense that there was more than just the forces of wind and weather at work when Hurricane Katrina worked its way up through the Gulf Coast a couple days ago. Does it have anything whatsoever to do with the cross? And where was God in all of this? Pastor Bill Swirla is our guest. Bill, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Todd. Peace be with you.
And with you as well. You know, the dispensationalists, I've heard them say that Hurricane Katrina, this is more than a coincidence, they say, that Hurricane Katrina hits the U.S. right down there in our southern Sin City, right as the U.S. is pushing the Israelis to withdraw from Gaza. How do you respond to that explanation?
Yeah, you must hang out with a different crowd there. I haven't heard that one yet. I always thought it was only the liberals that blamed President Bush for everything. So this is kind of a new one on me. My response is first of all, they may be talking to a different God than I know too. I'm not really sure how they get this idea. You know, an event like this is a little bit like a symbol. In order to be able to interpret it accurately, you need some words of interpretation, and truthfully, I don't know where they get those words from. My response is this is an old fallacy of correlation and cause. It's a little bit like saying every time I take Uncle Harry out on a picnic, it rains. Therefore, we're not taking Uncle Harry out on picnics anymore because he causes it to rain. There's no way to make that connection. Just because there are a bunch of things happening in the world and a bunch of things even happening in a city like New Orleans doesn't mean that you have the ability to connect the dots to say that A caused B. All you can say is what we know. They're occurring at the same time. It might be just sheer dumb luck and coincidence. It might be something else. If God has a message, I'm sure we'll hear from him.
Well, in, kind of embedded in that dispensational explanation, at least part of it, was the moralist's answer to the question of why Katrina. How would the moralist answer the question?
Well, yeah, you can. It depends what you want to push on. Obviously, New Orleans has kind of a signature for the party life, whether it's Mardi Gras, which begins, that's the day before Ash Wednesday, or things like Girls Gone Wild, or as I read somewhere, there's a supposed to have been some kind of homosexual event scheduled for next week. I think that will probably be canceled, and I think it'd be really simple. And I think deceptively simple to say, there's the reason why. Because we don't have that kind of an interpretation. Even the old biblical Sodom and Gomorrah, when God decided to zap a couple of cities, not only did he warn Lot and company in advance, but he's perfectly clear as to why he's doing it and what he's got in mind. We're not privy to that kind of, that's Luther's old hidden God. We're not privy to that information as to what he's up to. And, the Bible gives us a one-word answer, and that is repent. That doesn't mean asking everybody else to repent. That means us repenting, because we're seeing kind of a glimpse of something that's really, in the end, far worse.
What kind of a God, I mean, there are other answers here, I'll get to them in a minute, but what kind of a God would we have if the moralist answer to the question was right? Well, look, they were doing wrong. They basically kind of ticked God off, and God threw a hurricane their direction. What kind of a God would this be?
Well, first of all, that'd be a strange way to operate a cosmos, because if everybody got exactly what their sins deserved, then we would have a depopulated universe. It's like this idea we have to rid the world of evildoers. Well, extrapolate that to its proper end, and that means there are no people in the world because we're all corrupt and evil at our hearts anyway. And so first of all, the idea is kind of silly because you're not going to be left with any worshipers if you're just going to rid the world of sinners. Secondly, it kind of lends into a very bizarre sort of world where people get zapped the instant they do something that ticks God off. And I think most of all, we don't have a God of mercy, compassion, love, kindness, and especially forgiveness, the one who is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, and who does not hold the sins of the sinner against him, but indeed has given his Son as the atoning sacrifice for the sins of the entire world. All of that is gone, so you don't have a gospel.
So what would the environmentalists give as an answer to why Katrina?
So failure to sign the Kyoto Agreement, clearly. We've definitely got that, and our driving our SUVs and every other contribution to global warming. And again, the good scientists will say, be careful about correlation and cause. Some of this may indeed be due to man-made shifts in the environment. There's a strong scientific debate out on that, and science is really good at kind of trying to sort out what is just a correlative effect, the two things happen to occur at the same time, and what actually causes things. I'm always reminded of anecdotal medicine. This is the stuff that drives anecdotal medicine. Eating a pound of chocolate a day cured Aunt Harriet of her dandruff, so therefore chocolate cures dandruff. Well, that just may have been Aunt Harriet. It may have been coincidence. There may be something to it. But you have to look at this very carefully, and by looking at the various factors and the variables that go into it, make connections. That's the way a scientist would approach that. So the same thing, environmentalists or global warming or whatever you want to attribute to cause, those things need to be studied. We may actually have a tiger by the tail here. Hard to say. It certainly doesn't help the people in New Orleans with kind of those kinds of explanations. And by the way, if I could add, because we're on this topic, I hope that nothing that I say theologically or otherwise, is understood in a glib fashion. This magnitude of human suffering is just heart-wrenching. And the way we're able to observe that from a distance by television and have that as part of our lives, even though it's very far away, I know fills me and my people and my congregation with a deep sense of helplessness, because you really want to be able to do something and to help your neighbor in need. And certainly we can all pray, and we are all praying, and we will be giving very generously to helping these people in need. But I don't think that anything that I say here fully appreciates the magnitude of the suffering that is resulting here.
How would liberalism respond to the question of why Katrina?
You got to get a liberal on the phone. I don't know. You got to talk to get somebody else. I hesitate to answer that question. I really, really don't know, and it kind of depends out of what frame. Truthfully, Todd, I'm going to punt on that one, because I really hesitate to speak for somebody else. I can tell you what I have to say about it, but I don't know.
All right, then, is God answering the question?
No, and that's the bottom line, and I'm glad you asked it that way. And, you know, when God is silent, that's when we start chattering. The why question is the one question that gets very lean treatment in the Bible. And yet, ironically, there's an entire book of the Bible really devoted to the why question. That's the book of Job, where Job is stricken by horrible suffering, and only the reader knows why. And it's a reason you wouldn't have cooked up that God and the Satan are having this little side bet over why Job is so devoted to the Lord. And Job doesn't know this. His friends don't know it. They never know it. Even Job, never at the end of the book, he never learns why all these bad things happen to such a decent guy. But the readers know it from the first few chapters. And I like the commentary of a rabbi who said when Job's friends came, the three friends that came to comfort him, they sat with him for 7 days and said nothing. And the rabbi said that's the best thing they could have ever done for him. But when they opened their mouths, you see, that's when the trouble started, because they tried to break the silence of God with their own attempts to theologize. And their theologizing is very predictable. Job, there's something wrong in your life. That's why you're suffering. You know, so get right with God, and God will get right with you. And so they did that correlation cause thing. Aha, Job, you're sick, you're suffering. There must be sin in your life that's unrepentant. You need to do the heart work. You know, you need to get in there and clean out that sin and get right with God, and then all this stuff's going to turn around. And meanwhile, Job, they're just adding to his suffering. They're making him worse. Not only is he physically and medically sick, he's becoming theologically sick to his stomach, too. It's a horrific thing. And finally, God appears in no less than a whirlwind, in a hurricane, in the 38th, 39th chapter of Job, and asks a bunch of questions. You know, questions like, well, were you around when I made the sea and the dry land, when I put the sea in its place and told the waves you can come this far, no further? And just a whole bunch of questions out of the mysteries of creation. And the obvious answer to all of them is, I don't have a clue. I don't know. I wasn't there. And that's really the point. I'm God. You're not God. And that ultimately is very, very good. And that in faith we need to embrace that.
So how do we know it's good if all the evidence to our eyes, and if we put ourselves, say, in Job's shoes, all the evidence to our eyes and the circumstances of our life says, God, it literally got me on the end of the string, and he's just yanking me whatever direction seems to amuse him at this moment.
How do you convince yourself God is good when he's treating you like an enemy? Which is really, that's Job's situation. They say it a number of times. You become the enemy. Yahweh is your enemy. And there's only one way. This is where the theology of the cross is so essential, and that's why it is the Christian faith in its essence. There's only one way to know the goodness of God, and it's not gawking at lofty mountains or beautiful cumulus clouds or going for a walk on the beach and looking out at the ocean, because we see the other side of that. That is fearsome. And you can't really know. You get a mixed signal. God is certainly creative and he's powerful, but egads. You know, the power of that storm is just beyond our imagination. The only way we can know the goodness and the mercy of God is the face of Jesus Christ, particularly his dead face on the cross, where he becomes the sufferer, and he literally, in his own flesh, takes up all of this human suffering, whether it's caused by man against man or whether it's caused by the forces of nature turned against us. He takes up all of that suffering into his own body and his own being, and he makes it good in his death. But that's it. That's what we've got. We've got a death and a resurrection. And I would maintain that is enough. That is sufficient. As he says, it is finished. And see, he asks the why question. For all of humanity, my God, why have you forsaken me? And you know the Bible. Todd, what's the answer?
Well, the answer is because of my sin.
Well, that's, no, you're answering. What answer does dying Jesus get in his hour of suffering? Well,
he gets silence. He gets death.
He gets silence on behalf of all of us. He dives into the silence of that God-forsakenness, and he comes out of it 3 days later with a new creation. That's the beauty of that. That's what we got to hang on to. That's what we have to preach, and I understand it's easy to say that when you're not in the midst of it. But one day, whether personally and individually in the hour of our death or in the day of destruction on the last day, or perhaps when some calamity hits us, that's the certain thing to cling to is crucified and risen Jesus, who makes all things good in his death and resurrection.
We're talking to Pastor Bill Swirla about Hurricane Katrina and the theology of the cross. He's written something on his blog about this issue. I do recommend you read it, folks. You can find it at higherthings.org, higherthings.org. Click blogs, and you'll find Pastor Swirla's blog, higherthings.org. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, calling from his car. Barry, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Pastor, for taking my call.
Sure.
In the transition of moving to New Orleans, I fortunately, I guess by the grace of God, he didn't allow us to sell our house as quickly as we would have liked, and so we're not supposed to move for another month, which, of course, will be delayed, but... I heard you talking about the festival coming up. It kind of glibly crossed my mind that, they call it decadence. It's every Labor Day weekend. It's, homosexual, gathering, and I don't know what exactly goes down. They just say you don't want to go down there that weekend into the French Quarter. But I guess I wanted to try and get a couple comments. I guess when I see a disaster like this, the short answer to me is we live in a sinful world, and people don't like to hear that, but we live in a simple world, and we have tragedies every day. Maybe not this big, but that's what the result of living in this world is. And then the other thing is, I guess, from the good pastors that I've had, is that if we want to encourage ourselves, if anything, we should be in these waters and looking to the waters of our baptism for God's grace. And I'd just like to hear your comment on that, and I'll hang up and listen.
Barry, thank you very much for your comments. Pastor Swirla, your response.
I like to listen to Barry's theology. I will sit and listen to him for a long time. I don't know if I can improve on what he said. He said a bunch of things. I was making notes. One is he refuses to make, even though it's tempting to make correlations between much of what we kind of know publicly about a particular city, about a party town like New Orleans, that doesn't tell the whole story of the city either. There are all sorts of God-fearing people who live there who are like us, essentially. And so you can't just paint such a big fat brush and say, that's why it happens, because everybody's affected without discrimination here. I love the idea that he points us to the certainty of our baptism, and that when the waters roar and foam and we are in doubt and despair as to whether God is merciful, that there is a creative water, the water of our birth and our renewal, that same element that brings so much destruction as it once did in the flood, and as it does here in the storm, that element of water is the instrument of the Holy Spirit's regeneration and renewal in our baptism. It's almost a law gospel parable, just using water. I really appreciate that. And he said, you know, it's the reality of being sinners living in a fallen world. I'm drawn to Romans 8. I did a Bible study with my teachers here yesterday about how Paul talks about the entire creation is subjected to futility and to decay. And yet, here's the beautiful thing, both from Jesus and from his apostle, St. Paul. These things are viewed not as death throes, but they're viewed as birth pangs, the labor pangs of the new creation, because this whole creation is set into futility in the hope of the resurrection, the renewal of our bodies, you know. And so even the wind and the waves suffer the disharmony of our fall and our disobedience. Because we are the head of creation, and when Adam and Eve sinned and fell, they dragged a whole cosmos into chaos again and disorder. And it's really by the mercy of God that we're just not swallowed up in it entirely anyway, but that out of it the sun has redeemed the cosmos, and so there's hope. As the rainbow is the sign of that God would never destroy the world in this way. There's that hope now in the resurrection of Christ that a new creation has already come, and it's ours through our baptismal faith, and it's sure we can cling to it even if we lose our lives.
We ask why, when Hurricane Katrina or whatever other hurricane or disaster strikes, we don't ask why when we wake up in the morning, step out onto the front porch, and it's a beautiful day. Should we ask why, and would the answer still be the same?
That's a neat question. It's looking at it from the opposite perspective, and that is why am I even up this morning? And the answer is the same. It's by the mercy of God. I remember, and you probably heard this when we were at the seminary too, and I forgot who told it, but the story of some pastor or somebody who talked about in this way that a child is sick. And the church rallies together and prays for the child, and the child gets well again. And that's the mercy of God in Jesus Christ. And a child gets sick, and the church rallies around the child, and the child dies as a baptized child of God. And that, too, is the mercy of God. And yet only faith can say that of the second one, that this faith receives everything that comes as gift. Even when it seems to be the opposite, or when it seems to be saying the opposite, because, and for no other reason than the Son has embraced you in his death.
It seems as though all of these answers that you have responded to, the answers that really lead us nowhere close to what God is all about, all of them are an attempt to categorize God in some way. And I come back to what you talked about before in the book of Job, where God basically ends the book with Job saying, I know you're trying to figure me out, but give up. I'm God. I'm the only one who gets me. And the only way you're going to know me is through the goodness of my son, Jesus Christ. And that's it. If you want to know something about me beyond that, you will find nothing but caprice and confusion and chaos.
And Job ends so nicely, because Job repents of everything he said in the entire book. So that ought to teach us about quoting from the book of Job. You know, he repents of everything he said, everything that his friends said, and he worships. And that's the neat thing, is the book of Job ends with the sufferer at worship, which is really about that's all there is. That's all there is to worship. And by that, of course, as Christians, we mean to be on the receiving of God's giving, you know, his forgiveness, the body and the blood, and to cling to these things when everything else testifies against it, and to worship, because we know a greater truth than a meteorologist could tell us or an environmental scientist could tell us. We know that the cosmos is died for, and that it's redeemed, and that God has reconciled the world. I wish sometimes we would actually do just the Greek transliteration, that God in Christ has reconciled the cosmos to himself, and he does not count men's sins against them.
Two quick final questions. Someone says, you still haven't answered it correctly. The answer is, the devil did this one. What's your response?
You know, well... You know, in Job, it's the Satan who is the active agent, but it's very clear that it's all done by God's permission. And in fact, he goes no further with Job than what God himself allows. And that fits in nicely with what we say in the catechism. I think it's the Large Catechism that actually refers to the devil as God's devil. That is, you know, as one chained up like a rabid dog, he can only go so far and no further. Again, it's a way of looking at it. It takes a small slice of the truth. But a slice of the truth is not really going to be helpful here. That is, the powers of darkness and everything else, yes, these too are conquered by Christ. And the devil's big lie, the one he wants you to bite into, is that God is not good, that he is not gracious, that he does not forgive the sinner, but indeed he gives the sinner what he deserves. You get what's coming to you. That's what the devil would love to do with an event like this.
So how do we find comfort in the cross of Christ at times like this with 30 seconds, Bill?
I think the comfort in the cross is the same as we live under every day, though you and I probably take it for granted enormously. And I think the stories will kind of come filtering through as they always seem to, and that is to cling to the Christ who is there for you in your baptism, in the preached word, in the word of forgiveness, in the body and the blood. He has promised that he will never leave us. He will never forsake us. He's right there in the eye of the storm to save us.
Pastor Bill Swirla is pastor of Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Hacienda Heights, California. You can read this excellent bit on his blog at higherthings.org, higherthings.org. Click on blogs and you'll find this Why by Bill Swirla. Thanks for being our guest again.
Thanks, Todd.
How would you like to be God over the last week or so? You know, I sit here on the radio and I say things on the air, and then I can read various places where what I said was misinterpreted or people are misunderstanding what I'm saying. How would you like to be God today with all of the wrong answers that people are giving for what he has wrought? Listen carefully to how he answers the question. The answer is in the cross of his son, Jesus Christ. The answer is in his son, dead for sinners and alive again after 3 days. That answer will have to do, because that's the only answer he gives. Now, don't just sit in front of your television or your computer tonight and do nothing. Help your neighbor as far away as they are by making a contribution to LCMS World Relief. Their toll-free number, 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438, or go to our website and look for the LCMS World Relief logo there, issuesetc.org. You can even download some bulletin inserts for this Sunday, issuesetc.org or 1-888-930-4438. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.